I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, the fight today in the U.S. Congress over counting the Electoral College votes. But first, the fight in Harrisburg yesterday when Republicans who hold a majority in the Senate refused to swear in Jim Brewster, Democrat from Allegheny County. He beat his challenger, Nicole Zicarelli, by just 67 votes, the result certified by the Department of State. Zicarelli has refused to concede and taken her case to federal court, which has yet to rule. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who presided over the session, was removed and the gavel taken from him. Here's a bit of what that sounded like. You're going to hear Senator Jay Corman, who became the acting president of the Senate after replacing John Fetterman. You're also going to hear Philadelphia Senator Anthony Williams, Democrat from Philadelphia, yelling objections.
As interim president pro tempore of the Senate, a motion has been made to invoke Section 576 of Mason's Manual, a legislative procedure to replace the lieutenant governor
president,
who has refused to perform
Mr.
the duty.
Mr. President, I am
in
totally
accordance with the Senate
this.
Powers under Article
2 of the
Pennsylvania
Senate.
Constitution.
It has not been acquiesced.
Question,
we are not changing the process.
Section
the chair is changing the rules as we move along. That is inappropriate. You are breaking the Constitution and the laws
the
of the Commonwealth and
the court,
violating the oath
of
office you've actually taken. There is nothing about this day that is appropriate. Nothing. And we will not lay down and roll over because you got four more folks from that side of the aisle. This is about Pennsylvania. It's not Democrats or Republicans. It's not about simply winning.
Joining us is WHYY's Katie Meyer, political reporter for WHYY. Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. So just how unusual was the session yesterday?
Oh, it was pretty unusual. I will say I've seen the Senate devolve into shouting like this before, but, it's not frequent. Last year it happened over Republicans trying to and successfully repealing the general assistance program, which gave small amounts of money to poor Pennsylvanians. And so in that case, pretty much the same thing happened. So Fetterman tried to give Democrats the floor to speak after Republicans had motioned, you know, not to let that happen. And they generally win motions because they have the majority. And in that case, they also invoked what you heard Corman yelling about or talking about, which is Mason's Manual, this provision to basically remove the presiding officer if he's not or he or she's not doing their duty, as the manual says. So anyway, it's this complicated procedural thing, but it's happened before. But it's rare. It's very rare. And at the time I saw it the first time, I had never seen it before, but clearly it's becoming more frequent.
Well, I was wondering about that, whether this tells us anything about the sort of bad blood between the Republican and Democratic parties in Pennsylvania, or certainly part of the leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think there's no question that this is the manifestation of some growing tension. And it is interesting that it's been happening so much in the Senate, just because, if Fetterman is presiding, he's from the opposite party. He clearly has no problem, you know, trying to use his place on the rostrum as, a way to push Republicans who do control the chamber. So, you know, I think what you're seeing is a Democratic lieutenant governor who is, you know, more forceful, more willing to sort of, you know, in a manner of speaking, throw his weight around. And then you're also seeing Republicans who are trying to do, you know, some pretty, I would say, legally, if not questionable, then certainly unusual things. Refusing to seat Senator Brewster, which we can get into, I'm sure,
is
unusual. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Senator Brewster. He has been a senator in the legislature. He's from Allegheny County. He's a Democrat. He was in a race against Nicole Zicarelli. I read that there was something like 67. I think you wrote that there were 67 votes between the two of them. What do we know about this race?
Yeah, so this is a conflict that goes back all the way to before the election. So basically, there has been, because we saw such a big, big increase of mail voting in Pennsylvania after we expanded no-excuse mail voting, there's been this conflict over when ballots cannot be counted. So in this race, there were 300-some ballots that did not have dates on them. And so, and this is a district, by the way, that, straddles Allegheny, which is heavily Democratic, and Westmoreland counties, which is more Republican. And so There were some ballots in both counties that didn't have dates on them. And, you know, generally, it's in the Constitution that, like, okay, ballots that don't have dates, you know, like basically voters shall, is the language, shall sign and date their ballots. So there was a question of like, well, if they don't have dates, can they be counted? And basically what ended up happening was that the counties had some leeway to make a decision for themselves. So Westmoreland did not count those ballots. Allegheny Wow. County did, tally those ballots. And then when the Supreme Court ruled that they could be counted, because this did go to the state Supreme Court first, then Allegheny County included those ballots, those non-dated ballots, in the total. That put Brewster over Ziccarelli. Those ballots are the ones that decided this election. And the Secretary of State confirmed that count and confirmed Brewster as the winner. So this is based on, again, a very small number of ballots based on two counties doing kind of different things, which we saw all across the state. And then the Supreme Court upholding that decision to count those ballots, and which the county didn't do until the ruling. And then the state confirming it, Secretary of State Kathy Buchbaugh confirming it. So, you know, that generally is enough to end a race. Now, in this case, Republicans are saying, you know, we don't believe that the state Supreme Court's ruling was right. Ziccarelli has filed this long petition to the Senate asking them to, you know, saying that she believes that this is incorrect. Brewster filed a response. So what the Senate's saying now is we want to wait until an appeal in federal court is decided, another case in federal court on the same issue. And they say they have to, you know, review these appeals that Ziccarelli and Brewster have now both filed. And it's kind of unclear. I mean, they've given some criteria. They want to read through it. They want to see what their own powers in this situation are. But, you know, basically they're saying we're going to keep the seat empty for now. And Democrats say that's acceptable. It's been confirmed. Department of State, there should be no question about this. This is not a federal issue. We shouldn't be waiting for this to happen. That's kind of where we are.
Well, do we know, has the federal court, and which federal court is it? Have they given any indication when they might make a ruling on determining what to do about these votes?
I'd have to check which – it's federal district court. I'd have to check which one. I believe it's out in Allegheny County because that's where this is. But, they've given no timeline, and that's kind of the other challenge here is that, you know, now that the Republicans have successfully kept it empty, everybody else was sworn in and not Brewster, it's not clear how long it's going to stay empty and how long the people of the 45th District are not going to have a representative in the state Senate. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a big question. I think certainly – you know, Democrats tried to come to some sort of a compromise on this. You know, Fetterman has said in interviews that he tried to say to Senate majority leaders, you know, what if we fill the seat provisionally since the state has confirmed Brewster is the winner? He takes the seat for now. But if there is some, you know, federal ruling that counteracts that, you know, then we can move to maybe remove him and instate Ziccarelli. So we're in sort of uncharted legal territory here. And I think you saw how that manifested yesterday.
Absolutely. Has the governor weighed in on this at all? I mean, I can imagine if he has what he has said, but where does he stand? And does he have any clout in getting past this conflict?
Yeah, Wolf doesn't really have any clout here. He did put out a statement yesterday basically saying he stands with Fetterman and his decision to attempt to instate Brewster. He has said, I'm just looking at his statement now, that Brewster rightfully won the 45th Senate District. Senate Republicans are ignoring the voters. He called it a shameful power grab. And, you know, I'll just read, it's simply unethical and undemocratic to leave the district without a voice simply because the Republicans don't like the outcome of the election. He was quite clear on this. I think it's worth noting that the last time Fetterman clashed like this with Republican leaders, they actually went to Wolf and told him to talk to Fetterman and, you know, basically said, smooth this over. He's not following the rules of the Senate. And Wolf actually did in that case. I think he told Fetterman, like, okay, let's let this one go. But in this case, clearly that is not happening. Although, again, Wolf doesn't have a ton of power here.
Sure. And what is Fetterman's relationship with the Republican leadership in the Senate? I mean, do they, I mean, what we heard is, I mean, obviously what happened yesterday, it was quite contentious, but under normal circumstances, is there some give and take?
Yes, there is, certainly. I think, you know, they work together. They have to work together. I will say Republicans have always viewed Fetterman, and they've said this publicly, so this isn't just like my own analysis. They viewed him as somebody who doesn't really want to be presiding. They view him as somebody with aspirations to higher office. And they think, especially last time when this kind of chaotic clash first happened, they said he doesn't know the rules of the Senate and is not following them. And so, you know, they were pretty harsh. And they basically told him, like, go study the rules, man. But, you know, he is the presiding officer of the Senate, and whatever else, you know, they think about him, they can't get rid of him. So there's definitely, I guess I say this to say, there has been tension, both professional and personal, before. And I haven't seen a ton of, you know, Democratic lieutenant governors interact with the GOP Senate, but it does seem unusual. The Senate's usually a pretty collegial body, especially compared to the House.
Here's a tweet from Aja. I'll just read it. This is part of the election code regarding contested elections. There's a pending appeal in federal court. The state decision will likely be upheld, but it has not been decided. It was Lieutenant Governor that erred. He eschewed protocol. So I'll just put that out there. Looking ahead, though, and this sort of a inauspicious start to this new session in the legislature in Harrisburg, what's on the docket, Katie? What are there some big issues that the state's going to have to grapple with?
There are, as always. But yes, there absolutely are. One of the big ones that I personally am going to be watching is there's been this Republican push to create Supreme Court districts. So state Supreme Court justices right now are elected in statewide party elections. There's been this Republican push to create districts because they believe too many justices come from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Four are from the Pittsburgh area right now, one's from Philly, and two are from outside of the sort of big metro areas in Pennsylvania. And so anyway, they say the court is biased towards Democrats. The way to fix this is judicial districts. There are lots of opponents of this. It's, you know, Pennsylvania Bar Association, places that don't necessarily aren't seen as like allies of Democrats. But what they say is, like, this would just create basically a court that looks like the legislature, that this is an inappropriate way of picking justices. And, you know, it's worth noting only two other states, you know, do it like that, select judges like that. So that's going to be, it's a constitutional amendment. So Wolf has no power here. They already passed it once. Session, they need to pass it one more time, then it goes to a vote referendum, and those usually pass. Not always, but they usually do. So anyway, that's one of the big things I
sure.
think
you know what,
coming
Katie,
out this session.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks for joining us today in Radio Times. That's WHYY's political reporter, Katie Meyer. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times once again.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Coming up, the fight today in the U.S. Congress over counting the Electoral College votes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Mott.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Under normal circumstances, the Congress and the Vice President of the United States meet every 4 years in January for a joint session to count the Electoral College votes from each state, the final step after the November election. The January 6th session is generally a pro forma exercise, with the Vice President opening certificates from the states, naming electors who are counted, leading to the naming of the next president and vice president. While we know that Joe Biden won 306 Electoral College votes to Donald Trump's 232, making him the 46th president of the United States, this year the process will not be so predictable. A sizable group of Republicans is challenging the electors in certain states, including Pennsylvania. It's a move that has split the GOP and raised questions about the Electoral College itself. Why do we choose our presidents this way? Joining us is Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Ron Elving, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
And also with us is Claire Finkelstein, and she's a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, also the director of the School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Claire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty, as always.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Ron, I just have a few questions about the Georgia election, watching the tallies last night swinging between the Democrats and then the Republicans and the Democrats. Reverend Ralph Warnock has been declared the winner, beating Kelly Loeffler, who had been appointed to the job. What is the significance of his win?
Reverend Warnock, as everyone I think at this point knows, is the latest occupant of the pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist in downtown Atlanta. That was, of course, the church of Martin Luther King Jr., also the church of his father, Martin Luther King Sr., and an extraordinarily important landmark monument to the African-American church in America. So he says that he is going to continue to preach on Sunday mornings and maintain his connection to Atlanta and to Georgia and to the people that he will serve for the entire state. I was about to say the people who voted for him, but he made a big point last night in saying that his job was to represent Georgia, whether people voted for him or not.
He's African-American, and we don't want to bury the lead here. Very few African-Americans have served in the U.S. Senate.
That's right. And most of them, of course, have been in the Democratic Party. But there is Tim Scott from just over the line in South Carolina, who has gotten more attention this past year. And I think we'll probably be getting more attention as we go forward. It is stunning to see an African-American both nominated by the once white-dominated Democratic Party of Georgia and then elected statewide in a state that has been quite red in recent years. It used to have a long-standing Democratic tradition until the 1990s. And actually, Bill Clinton carried it once for president. But it has gone very much to the Republican Party at the statewide level and in presidential elections until 2020. And the name of another African-American person, Stacey Abrams, who very nearly won the governorship a couple of years ago, needs to be mentioned right here because Stacey Abrams, as an organizer of the African-American vote, has proven herself absolutely nonpareil, not just in Georgia, not just in the South, but in the United States. So she has organized and brought out a very strong African-American vote, not only in November to elect Joe Biden, but also to make those Senate races too close to call. Back in November, they were under 50% for the leading candidates. That's why we had two runoffs yesterday. And it's also why Reverend Warnock won. And there appears to be a pretty good size poll for John Ossoff because of Warnock voters also voting for him.
Yeah, and just a quick question, and then we will move on to what's going to happen in Congress today. But the Ossoff-Purdue race, still not declared, too close to call. Ossoff looks like he's ahead by, well, I don't know, 10,000 votes. It's going to change probably as the day goes on. But let's assume if he does win, and it looks like the votes would be coming from some of the places that have not declared yet, that tend to vote Democratic. If he wins, you've got a 50-50 Senate, and you've got Kamala Harris presiding over the Senate. How does that change the U.S. Senate?
It changes it profoundly because, among other things, it takes away from Mitch McConnell, who has been the Senate Majority Leader, the power to determine what comes to the floor of the Senate. So for the last couple of years, while Nancy Pelosi has been Speaker again in the House and the Democrats have been in control there, they have sent over more than 300 pieces of legislation that got nothing in the Senate. No consideration at all, never brought to the floor, never assigned to a committee, nothing. And that was because of the authority invested in the Senate Majority Leader, at least under the Republicans. They were able to absolutely block hundreds of pieces of legislation. And some of these were enormously important pieces of legislation, among other things, reforming Election Day, and among other things, granting another $3 trillion in COVID relief and economic relief way back last May. Way before we spent 8 months deciding whether or not we wanted to do any more for the economy or for fighting the pandemic. That would have made a big difference if that could have happened back in May, and Mitch McConnell simply refused to consider it. Now, in fairness to Mitch McConnell, he was doing the will, not only of the president of the United States, but often in contradiction to the president, he was doing the will of the majority of Senate Republicans. As long as they were in the majority in the Senate, they were going to call the shots, and Mitch was just going to be articulating what they decided. And that's where we have been, and that is going to change profoundly if he is no longer the Senate Majority Leader.
Well, a fascinating couple of hours, days ahead. Claire, let me shift gears. Let's talk about the Electoral College. Let's talk about what's going to happen in the Congress today. Can we say, in spite of what happens today, that that Joe Biden will be sworn in on January 20th as the 46th president of the United States? Claire.
Marty, absolutely he will be. There is no lawful procedure by which he can be denied that inauguration. And what's going to happen today is going to be more theater than legal procedure. And it's very similar, really, to what we've been talking about in Harrisburg. Yeah. Namely, it is a staged protest to the results of the election. It is going to make a lot of noise, but it's not going to make any difference to the outcome. There's no possible legal way that it can. But it's extremely concerning that this kind of seditious mindset has taken hold in Washington and really spread, as we see, connecting these two sets of protests, in effect, to the state election machinery as well.
Well, and Ron, I just want to quote a couple of people, including Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who tweeted, "A fundamental defining feature of a democratic republic is the right of the people to elect their own leaders. The effort by Senators Hawley, Cruz, and others to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in swing states like Pennsylvania directly undermines this right." Ben Sasse, former House Speaker Paul Ryan, there's a long list of Republicans who really strenuously Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, who object to what's happening in the Senate today. What does that tell us about the party?
The party is dividing between those who feel it is in their best interest to stay close to President Trump and parrot anything that he says and go to the max to defend anything that he says or to even act on what he says, whether they feel that in their heart of hearts or not. Because they feel that the supporters of Donald Trump, the people who are also massing out on the mall right at this moment, tens of thousands of them, possibly into six figures and well into six figures, those people, the populist base of the Donald Trump Republican Party, is absolutely essential to their own future. So if you're Josh Hawley from Missouri or Ted Cruz from Texas, and you're thinking about running for president in 2024, maybe thinking about little else, you are absolutely worried about those people turning on you if Donald Trump turns on you, as he has turned on a number of other senators already and called them out, not just Mitt Romney, but the number two Senate Republican leader, John Thune of South Dakota. And the president says, we've got to get a primary against him. His career is over. And if you are a Republican senator or, for that matter, a House member, and there are a number of Pennsylvania House members we expect will object today, if you're one of those people and your voters in your district or in your state still love Donald Trump, and we know many people do, it is a kind of political suicide for you within the party to oppose Donald Trump.
Wow. Well, let's talk about Vice President Pence. And Claire, I'll go back to you. On Monday, when President Trump was in Georgia, he called on Pence to, quote, do the right thing, and then sort of joked about, maybe I won't like him very much anymore. And apparently this morning he tweeted out that Pence can send back votes and he will win. What options, or does the vice president have any options besides opening envelopes and reading results?
No, he really doesn't, Marty. And it's really interesting because the pressure that Trump has put on Vice President Pence is almost like a microcosm of the pressure that he's put on the Republican Party more generally. The same demand that he made of the Georgia Secretary of State to come up with over 11,000 new votes and recertify the results. There is no legal way that Pence can do anything other than open the envelope and announce the winner. You know, it would be like at the Emmys, having the announcer suddenly decide that he was going to plump for a different winner when the judges have already decided. It is in effect a kind of teleprompter function that Pence is serving, and Donald Trump is not making that claim or putting that pressure based on any kind of legal research. I was impressed, in fact, to learn that Pence had done a fair bit of research, was taking his role fairly seriously, and had explored whether or not there was any legal basis for him to play a different function, and there really isn't. So should he choose to cave to the kind of pressure that Donald Trump is putting him under today, he will have to be removed from his role in this case because he simply has no function in announcing any other result.
That's Claire Finkelstein. And also with this, Ron Elving, we're talking about what's going to happen in the Congress today, a joint session of Congress where the Electoral College votes are counted, presided over by Vice President Pence. I do want to play a clip of Al Gore, but Ron, let me just give you a chance to weigh in. I mean, does Pence have any, I don't know, wiggle room, any options besides just doing this ceremonial job?
The one thing that he could do would be to literally recuse himself, say, it's awkward for me. I'm on the ballot. I'm one of the people on the Republican side on the ballot. And so I think it would probably be better if I just recuse myself here and step down, and I won't attend the session at all. There is actually precedent for that. Hubert Humphrey did not come in 1968 when he was in much the same a very similar position. He was the Democratic nominee in 1968, and he had lost to Richard Nixon, but he was still the Vice President of the United States. And he went to a funeral in Europe. He went to a funeral for the original Secretary General of the United Nations. And that was certainly a sensible thing for him to be doing as Vice President, that is, attending the funeral. But, of course, he could have canceled out of going to that if he really had wanted to be there, or if the Constitution had absolutely required him. But the Constitution provided a safety valve here, which is the Senate President pro tempore, which is an office that always exists and most people usually don't notice, although it does have a very nice office in the Capitol. And that is a senator from Iowa named Charles Grassley, who happens to be the most senior member of the majority party. He's a Republican. And so for at least a few more days, he is going to be the Senate President pro tempore, and he has made it clear he's available today to preside as needed, and will probably preside when the Senate goes to their own chamber to debate whatever objections are raised today.
Well, let me play something from January 6, 2001. This is Vice President Al Gore, who, as we know, ran against George W. Bush for the presidency. Here is announcing the official tally of the Electoral College votes. Let's give it a listen.
This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected president and Vice President of the United States, each for the term beginning on the 20th day of January 2001, and shall be entered, together with a list of the votes, on the journals of the Senate and the House of Representatives. May God bless our new President and our new Vice President, and may God bless the United States of America.
So, Claire, there he is essentially announcing, and we know that was a very contested election, but nonetheless, there's Al Gore basically saying, I lost, he won.
Well, that's right. And the idea of concession, of course, is part of our democracy. It's part of the peaceful transition of power. It's how we move from one administration to another under ordinary circumstances. And the foolish thing about this scorched earth policy that the Republicans are engaging in right now is that ultimately it will now deprive them of power that they would have perhaps been able to negotiate in a 50-50 Senate. So given that it seems highly likely that Ossoff will also win his bid to become a Georgia senator, what will happen is the Senate will obviously be split down the middle, and then Kamala Harris, as vice president, will cast deciding votes on all matters, including who goes on which committees. And there is a precedent for saying in a situation like this, well, we'll just split the committee membership evenly. But Democrats really will not have the luxury of making sort of political concessions to Republicans that they don't have to make under these circumstances. They will know that they have to sort of beat back this kind of, as I said before, seditious mindset, because a certain segment of the Republican Party is really trying to, you know, burn our democracy down to the ground. Hmm. So I think that they will have to adopt very hardball tactics and use every ounce of power that they have to try to set our democracy back on a straight path.
Ron, and we're coming up on a break here, but can ballots be challenged for any reason? And I ask that knowing that there were something like 60 lawsuits coming from either the Trump campaign or Democrats that went through the state legal systems, one going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can any ballot be challenged for any reason?
If a member feels that the electors from a particular state, doesn't have to be his state or her state, if that member feels that those electors were improperly chosen, or if they feel that that needs to be aired and debated by the two chambers, they can object. They don't have to present any evidence in order to file an objection. They simply need to object and have in writing their objections, and then have a senator join them in those objections, and also have that in writing. And that just triggers a debate. Then they have to go to their respective corners of the Capitol, you know, Senate chamber, House chamber, and have 2 hours of debate and a vote, and a simple up or down vote to either support the objection or not support the objection. We don't expect any of the objections to be supported today. In fact, the vote will probably be heavier in the Senate majority, in the Senate Republican majority chamber, than it is in the House, because there are so many Republican senators who don't want to be associated with this seditious behavior, as Professor Finkelstein called it.
And that's Ron Elving, Claire Finkelstein. We are talking about what's going to happen in the U.S. Congress today regarding the Electoral College votes. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Also with us, Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. And we are talking about what's going to happen this afternoon, a joint session of Congress presided over by Vice President Pence. It is something that happens every 4 years, essentially counting the Electoral College votes and the final step after the November election. Let me play another clip. This goes back to January 6, 2005. Vice President Dick Cheney presides as members of the Senate debated an objection raised to the Ohio Electoral College vote presented earlier to a joint session counting Electoral College votes to certify the presidential election. Let's give it a listen.
After which the chair will put the question, shall the objection be sustained? The clerk will report the objection made in the joint session.
Ms. Tubb Jones, a representative from Ohio, and Mrs. Boxer, a senator from California, object to the counting of the electoral votes of the state of Ohio on the ground that they were not under all of the known circumstances regularly given.
Claire, I mean, obviously what's happening today, although I think the scale is rather different, it has clearly happened before where questions are raised about the Electoral College vote tallies.
Right. And so there is a procedure, and it can be lawfully invoked. But the point here is that there is no basis for invoking that procedure. With, as you mentioned, over 60 lawsuits, 61 in fact, that went in favor of Democrats and against the claim that there was any fraudulent behavior, we still have a president in office who was putting pressure on state election officials to simply magically change the vote. That is something that has never happened before in our history. And so those who are invoking the procedure to contest the counting of electoral votes are not doing so in a vacuum. They're doing so against the backdrop of the most extraordinary objection to a valid, lawful election that we have ever seen in our history, at least since the Civil War, and is polarized, contributing to the polarization of the country. What's sort of amazing is that their willingness to go along with this, because Donald Trump lost the election, he has convinced a large segment of the population and a surprising segment of actual lawfully elected representatives that they must side with him in objecting to the very elections that got them elected.
Yeah.
So it is questioning, it's bringing up not just our deep substantive differences in the country, but when you are actually debating the very rules that hold your democracy in place and using fantastical claims to try to defeat those procedures, then you know that you're really at the outer edge of what a democracy can bear.
I want to play one more clip, but just to add that Kerry, who lost in 2005, had already conceded the election to Bush when this these questions were raised. Let me play one more clip. This is Representative Barbara Lee. This is January 6, 2017, so not so long ago. She raised objections to Electoral College votes for Donald Trump during a joint session of Congress. And here you're going to hear Vice President Joe Biden cut her off. Let's give it a listen.
Mr. President, I object on behalf of the millions of Americans, including members of the intelligence community.
There is no debate. The debate is prohibited.
Interfered in our election.
The chair has previously ruled a signature from a senator is required. The objection cannot be sustained unless one is available.
Mr. President, despite grave concerns of the intelligence officials showing Russia interfered with our election, it is signed by—
Ron, what's happening there?
Well, the representative from California was articulating what many, many people were feeling in January of 2017, that there must have been something wrong with the election of Donald Trump. Now, he had lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes to Hillary Clinton, and yet he had squeezed by in Pennsylvania, as you know, Michigan and Wisconsin, with just enough votes in each of those three states to win the Electoral College. So to a lot of people's shock, because I think even Donald Trump sort of expected to lose that election in 2016, he was suddenly the president. And in search of an explanation, quite a few people fell upon the feelings of the intelligence community, quite universally within the intelligence community, that much of the social media activity and other activity that had gone on in the, using various platforms of the internet during 2016 had come from elements of the intelligence community of the Russian Federation, that this was Putin's work, that Putin's people had been interfering with that election and that they had put a pretty big thumb on the scale in a variety of ways that are probably too complicated to get into right now, but that they had interfered and tried to mess up that election in 2016, which, of course, became a major legal and political theme of the first several years of Donald Trump's presidency.
But what we also hear is then Vice President Joe Biden gaveling her quiet, saying, look, you can object, but it sounds like you need a senator to be able to move this forward.
Precisely. And John Kerry did not even attend the session. He was still in the Senate at the time. He had been the Democratic nominee. But this was really officially, as was the case in 2001 with Al Gore, that the Democratic senators got together and discussed this and said, listen, you know, there's really no path here to overturning this result. And so to prolong it and to imply that in some way or another it can be overturned is unconscionable. And so Al Gore asked them not to, and Joe Biden, as you heard, gaveled down the single House member.
Here's an email from Mike. I'll put this to you, Claire. It says, how does it make sense that Cruz et al. Are supporting Trump's nonsensical protests if they plan to run in 2024?
Oh, that's an excellent question, because one of the things that I tweeted about this week was that Cruz is really committing, political suicide by doing this. I do not think that by the time we get to 2024, this behavior is going to look very good to the public anymore. It's sort of as though the country is caught in the grip of this illusion. And I do think that with the passage of time, there will be greater clarity about just how far out of our democratic process we have come with this presidency. I am hoping that the Biden administration can do a lot to restore our faith in democracy. And critical will be working on ways to educate the public so that the public and our elected representatives understand what is needed to maintain a democracy. I think by the time we get to 2024, those who supported this bid to overturn the election in 2020 will not be politically viable anymore, and they will be rejected by voters, as the results in Georgia are really indicating.
Well, I mean, it seems like 2024 is 1,000 years away in political years.
That's right. But in fact, it's really right around the corner.
And it so is. No, I understand.
It lost.
It never
in
stops.
In trying to get our system back on an even keel.
Ron, let me turn to you and Senator Hawley, who, in a sense, initiated this challenge to electors, is, as I understand it, focusing on Pennsylvania's electors. He apparently has presidential ambitions as well. What's his objection to Pennsylvania's electors?
He says that there were procedural changes made in Pennsylvania in advance of the November vote that should have been done by the state legislature and no one else but the state legislature, but that the courts took a role, and by having the courts involved in ordering some of those changes, that in some sense or another, that violated the U.S. Constitution. It's not an argument that's passed muster in the courts.
No.
It's not an argument that is going to convince very many people, I don't believe, in the legal community. But it is one that the Republicans have fastened on right from the very beginning and probably should have been brought as a lawsuit back in the fall. That would have given it a little better chance of getting a full hearing by the Supreme Court. But it's not going to prevail with the Senate today, and it's not going to prevail in the House today. In fact, I think, as I mentioned earlier, there are so many Republican senators who are sick of this thing that that there will probably be a higher percentage of votes against these objections in the Republican Senate than in the Democratic House. The Democratic House is barely Democratic, I should add,
yeah.
And the House Republicans are a somewhat more cohesive group. There's quite a few, I believe 100, who are planning to vote for the objections today.
Claire, I have a wonky constitutional question. Didn't the U.S. Supreme Court make a ruling about faithless electors, that electors had to represent the will of the voters in each state?
Well, in fact, and this happened over the summer, what the Supreme Court said was that laws, state laws requiring electors to vote for their pre-designated candidates, that was constitutional. Now, not every state has that, and Pennsylvania happens to be one of those states that does not have such a law. That is something that I believe will start to be revisited. More and more states do have those laws. Electors are no longer seen as these sort of freewheeling agents who can decide who they want to vote for after they have committed themselves. And the Supreme Court decision really suggested not only is it constitutional for a state to have a law requiring electors to vote for their pre-designated candidates, but the suggestion is that an elector could be removed even in a state for refusing to vote for their pre-slated candidate, even in a state that didn't have such a law. And so it really seems as though the role of the elector is more and more a pass-through rather than an independent decision.
Ron, let's go back to the dispute of 1876. And when we read about disputes over the Electoral College, that always comes up. Rutherford B. Hayes became president. What do we need to know about what happened then, and does anything apply to what's going on today?
The 1876 dispute, there were several states, several in the South plus Oregon, who had disputes over who the proper electors were. And in that era of Reconstruction, there were competing authorities in many of the previously Confederate states that had been in rebellion. So by 1876, Reconstruction was a strained proposition, certainly began as one. And the separate states of slates of electors were sent on to Washington. And so somebody had to decide which ones' votes were really legitimate. And depending on who got those votes, you were either going to have Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, or Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican, take over as president. Well, in the end, they couldn't decide, and there really was no clear authority for who should decide. And as a result, they put together a commission, and that commission met for weeks and weeks and weeks, and well into March, before they could finally come up with a deal whereby the Democrats were deprived of their chance at the presidency. Tilden had to stand down. But in exchange for that, and they gave all the disputed electors to Hayes, in exchange for that, the Republicans agreed to pull their troops, that is to say, the federal troops, the U.S. Army, out of the formerly Confederate states and let those states go back to having whatever kind of state government they wanted to have, which turned out to be largely run by white segregationists who deprived the formerly enslaved African Americans in the South of many of their rights, including their right to vote in many cases. So that is a tragic story. And as a decade later, the Congress finally acknowledged they hadn't really figured out how to handle all that kind of situation. They passed a law in 1887 to count the election the way we're counting it today. And it's still pretty antique, and it probably needs to be, in some sense or another, just eliminated. And depending on how messy things get today, maybe Congress will actually turn to that at some point in the near future.
Claire, we're almost out of time, but just picking up on what Ron Elving just said there, as you look at the Electoral College and this sort of indirect way that we elect our presidents, is it time to either jettison the thing or revisit it, rewrite it, rework it, reform it?
Yeah, I do agree with Ron that it is antique and that it serves little purpose. And what we see with the split between Electoral College votes and popular votes is it's just a recipe for inflaming sentiment and polarization in the country. The Electoral College really needs to be looked at. Now, it's not as though we wouldn't be having these objections and these this grandstanding that we're going to see today. If we did eliminate the Electoral College, but a lot of the mechanism could be simplified, and there might be more faith in the voting public if there were had to be a matchup between the popular vote and the person who ultimately wins the presidency, because the Electoral College just ends up looking like a kind of procedural formality that doesn't actually represent the will of the people. And in a democracy, that's intolerable. Faith in the system is really part of what we need in order to restore a sense of civic commitment in the country.
Well, I want to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Claire Finkelstein, thank you once again for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. She joined us by Skype, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Ron Elving, thank you very much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And he's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the program wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.